From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Speedy, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Jared Huntley, Senior Lead Optimization Engineer for Alchemy Labs, to discuss optimization in games. Get your notebooks out, folks. If everyone's ready, let's learn.
Jared, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So, Jared, can you introduce yourself a little bit and tell listeners who maybe haven't heard of you a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Jared Huntley. As you mentioned, I'm Senior Lead Optimization Engineer at a VR studio called Alchemy Labs. Prior to that, I worked for myself at, you know, contracting with different indie studios. Right before Alchemy, I worked on a large indie game called We Are OFK, which was like a music, episodic, animated game, kind of like a Telltale game, but with music. That was a really great project to work on, and it still feels like a fairy tale, but earlier this year, we won a Peabody Award for it, which was so cool. But yeah, prior to that, you know, I helped port games. I worked on some of my own indie games, and here in Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm based, I help run a game development community called the Cleveland Game Developers.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice. It's always great when we have community people.
Yeah.
People who are like, I mean, it's hard enough to have a career in this industry, but to actually devote enough of your time on top of that to, you know, bringing people together, which is like, I think a responsibility of all of us, but like, it's hard.
So Jared, as everyone else has alluded to, we don't really know much about optimization, even though Mark and I, you know, both program for games. We don't know what the heck we're doing, I guess, with respect to this.
Yeah.
So I would love a primer on what optimization looks like in the day-to-day life of Alchemy Labs as your job.
Yeah. So I'll probably be talking about optimization, you know, in a broad sense, because I've actually been an optimization engineer at a few different places.
Okay.
Prior to Alchemy, when I was porting games, I was mainly focused on porting, but a lot of that was just pure optimization. And prior to that, when I used to work in IT, I worked at a bank and I was optimization there, optimizing like large, boring bank systems. Mm-hmm. But in a broad sense, you know, optimization for games is just making everything run smooth, whether that's, you know, making sure the frame rate runs smooth, whether that's making sure that there's no frame rate dips or, you know, any lag, that things load quickly, and that, you know, it's just optimization is one of those things where you notice when it's not done, but when it's done right, it's just completely invisible because everything's kind of working as you'd expect.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a particular like stat benchmark that you're looking for that say that like to say that you've done a good job with respect to like optimization and such?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Okay.
And it really depends on the project and the platform.
Okay.
Because for example, you know, maybe you're trying to make, you know, 60 FPS, which I think is 16.7 milliseconds. So you want to make sure that everything is happening every frame there. You want it to be as consistent as it is. But sometimes, you know, if you're maybe working on a mobile game and you drop a few frames when you're loading and the screen's kind of fading, it's not that big of a deal. If you're doing the same thing in VR and you just drop a few frames, that's when you start making people sick and, yeah, you know, you really affect people. So a lot of that can change depending on the project, platform, how people are consuming the game and experiencing it and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I imagine it keeps it really interesting because every project you work on is going to be different. It might be targeting and optimizing for different things, and the levers you have available to pull and like the lever arm that you're working with is going to be different with different technologies. So that's fascinating.
Yep, that's absolutely correct.
Already learned stuff. Yes.
Good job, Ellen.
Well, Steven, she's has more points than you now.
Oh, no. I got to get better points. I've been asking all the questions.
Have you learned anything?
I mean, yeah, I have.
Okay.
It's just hard to quantify that. Anyways. So I know that there's not necessarily a controversy per se, but like I know that like sometimes people will start optimizing things right away as soon as they start like making a prototype, and I'm a little guilty of this myself because I'm like, well, we should probably do this at least a little efficiently so then I have to rewrite this later, even though I definitely will be rewriting it in a few months. So I'm curious your opinion on when is the best time to like actively start optimizing things.
Yeah. In the general sense, I would say, you know, as soon as possible, because the decisions you make earlier affect what you need to optimize later on down the road. So I think a lot of it comes down to planning and, you know, making sure that you have a good idea of how the hardware functions, how capable the hardware is, whether that's in line with the game you're working on. Because if you're trying to make, you know, an open world RPG that runs at 4K, 120 frames per second, and you're trying to put that on like a Switch or a phone, like, that's not going to work. And no amount of optimization is going to fix that.
Yeah.
But then you also bring up a good point about optimizing prematurely, which I think that's just something to keep in mind. That's a good thing to keep in mind. Because sometimes you can get kind of bogged down in, you know, writing a system that's, oh, this is so flexible, I'm going to be able to use it here, and I'm going to be able to use it here.
Yeah.
And if I write it like this, it's modular, and then you only use it like twice. And so sometimes that's like wasted time and wasted effort. A rule of thumb I normally go for is like, if you're working on a bit of code and you need it somewhere else, it's not worth the time to make it modular from the start. And so if you need it somewhere else, just copy it and paste it another time. Like, I know some software engineers are just like, oh, that's against the rules and tenets, like whatever. but then if you need it a third place, that's usually a good sign where, okay, maybe it's time to modularize it and, you know, invest some time into making sure it can be used. But most times, you know, you copy it like once or twice, then it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that it's become kind of folk wisdom, especially if you're a self-taught programmer. One of the things that like converts are the strongest adherents, right? So if you don't have a formal programming background, and this is, I'm describing me now, but I think this is true of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You get these messages about like how it's supposed to work. And then you really want to be a good student of that.
Right, right.
And so with a lot of the things you hear is, don't pre-optimize.
Yeah.
And it is interesting to hear your, I mean, I think, you know, it's your job. So I think there's maybe a little bit of that angle coming in. But I am someone who will pre-optimize as like part of my workflow. Like I will continually rewrite things as I go. And I do worry a lot about that being a problem. And just hearing you frame it, it's like, yeah, it's a problem. But it's, but like, you don't seem to be that worried about it compared to not optimizing.
Right.
It seems like that little bit of folk wisdom, which I've told other people, and it feels like a truism, is just maybe like, it's easier to recover from doing that wrong.
Sure.
I'm like giving myself a pass here, but it's kind of what I'm hearing from you, Jared. Like, are you giving me a pass or not?
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, you're optimizing, you know, early isn't preventing you from making progress on your game, or if it isn't, you know, getting you stuck in this endless cycle of writing something and re-optimizing it and not, you know, moving to other features, then I think it's, you know, generally pretty, you know, not that big of a deal.
Yeah. And if it is doing that, and it does, time to time, it's probably hard to not notice.
Yeah, I suppose so. Mm-hmm.
This is maybe a sidetrack, but as a, I feel like an external observer to this conversation because I am not a programmer. I do find it not surprising to hear you say that, though, Jerry, because it occurs to me that since you've spent a lot of time working on optimizing systems, you've also probably applied a lot of that same kind of thinking to your own workflow, which you're constantly asking the question. I love this question of this phrase, like more than anything. And that is the juice worth the squeeze? Yeah. So it doesn't surprise me to hear you think through those decisions like that, because it seems like just the kind of decision-making you're having to do with optimization in general in regards to the tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a great point.
Dang, that's cool.
Yeah. It's all about trade-offs.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense early on. I suppose when you get to the point where you're like getting closer to release and the game chugs along sometimes and you're trying to figure out how to fix that, that's when you'll be cursing your early self for your decisions you made right away.
Another factor is, you know, what we've been talking about now is just kind of when you're on the project from the start and you're able to kind of make those decisions and you're able to plan. The other thing, and I don't know, this might be more of the cases where you might, you know, there might be optimization engineers that need to come in, is when you have a studio that's worked on a game, maybe they've released it on PC or mobile and they want to port it to a console, or they want to port a, you know, PC game to mobile. And then they bring in a porting studio and they say, here's our game, here's the code, and we need you to get it running on this platform. And so that's a completely different approach where it's, hey, you're getting something where they've already made these decisions.
Right.
The project's, you know, already finished or nearly already finished. And you need to figure out how to get this thing into this box and for it to run at a certain amount of speed. And so that's kind of a different approach to optimization. I mean, a lot of the same, you know, tools when you're talking about the code level, but like strategy wise, it's, you know, you have some limitations because you can't rewrite features or say, oh, you know, the character can't jump as high in this version or things like that. So you have some strict limitations and you need to just find creative ways of working around those.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting because like older games oftentimes would release different versions on different consoles because like it wasn't as taboo, I guess, to do that. And who would notice or care?
Well, I think a lot of times features were like, the implementation was so much closer to the metal.
Yeah, that's true.
Like if you tried to write something that worked on a Super Nintendo and a Genesis, it would run at a quarter speed on both systems.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. That makes a big difference. You definitely have to keep parity now. There's much more pressure to keep parity now than there was in the past.
Yeah.
And it's definitely something that I didn't even consider. Like that is an aspect of the porting process that is really core to it, is that like you need to make sure that the game runs at a respectable speed everywhere it's available. Otherwise, like, you'll get complaints from Switch or mobile or PC or what have you about this thing, and like you'll realize you've done a poor job, and that will reflect poorly on your game and your sales.
This is why I describe myself at the top of the show as not having any experience with this, because I feel like I do think about it a lot, but it's always while I'm building, which that might be the better way to do it. But at the same time, like in our meetings and Dream Settler, we're always talking about things like, oh, this isn't quite working. We're not finished making it yet. Let's worry about that when we do our optimization pass,
right?
Which is this mythical thing that's going to happen. But in my heart, I know that that's not how I do this sorts of things.
Right.
But I know that I do have to wait on, like let's, okay, that slows things down, but there's all these other things that affect it. So let's not worry about that yet, because it's going to be a waste. It's not going to be worth the squeeze.
Yeah.
But I'm dreading, like, what happens when we lock it, and then I have to get into a mode where I try to fix things without also changing them.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I know how to do it. Mm. Right? And that constraint, I mean, I suppose when you have a client project, you have essentially no choice.
Yeah.
But what kind of challenges are you faced? Like, do you say, they just give you the code base and say, it's got to work on this system. What kind of communication is required? What's the production process like when it comes to that? When you say, like, I mean, I don't know if this is something that happens, but you say, like, we literally cannot meet this frame rate target. We need to change the target. But then that changes a bunch of things, and then you start pulling a thread. Like, when is it time to have those conversations versus when is it time to just say, like, this is the best it's going to be?
Yeah. So, I mean, it really depends on at what point you're coming onto the project. Because sometimes you might be brought on, like, the 50% point. Usually, I wouldn't say porting, you know, studios or porting partners are brought on before that. I'd say 50% is probably the earliest, and that's probably a small sliver.
Yeah.
But I'd say most of the time, 70 to 100%.
Yeah.
If you're in the 70%, you might have some say on some of the final decisions. Like, hey, if we make this approach, it's going to take a long time for us to rewrite this entire system. So let's write it like this. That way we don't have to worry about re-optimizing it later. But if you're brought on and the game's already done and you just need to, you know, get it to run on a platform, those are different approaches.
Yeah.
So I'd say the first thing that kind of dictates everything is the timeline, whether, you know, you have to get it done by a certain date or whether, you know, you're trying to hit, you know, holiday season, et cetera, because those are things you can't move. Mm-hmm. And then usually you'll, you know, as a, you know, porting engineer, optimization engineer, you'll kind of do a first pass. You'll look at the code, you'll play the game, you'll take notes and say, you know, this level's slow, this feature doesn't work quite right, or, you know, might be a problem on this platform.
Yeah.
And then once you start the process, you kind of continue that loop of, okay, now we finally got it running on the hardware and it's running at 15 frames a second. What's the slowest thing? What's the second slowest thing? What, you know, are the biggest things that are jumping out on the performance graphs? And then you can take it to your client, and, you know, they're kind of in charge of making the calls, like, hey, you know, this thing right here is probably going to take a week to optimize, but this other thing is going to take 2 weeks to optimize. But, you know, maybe they make the call not to optimize that other thing, that other feature, as much, because it only happens two times in the game.
Yeah.
And so if it's a little bit slow, maybe it's weird, or maybe it's the opposite. Because it happens two times, it's, you know, this special moment and they want it to stand out. So a lot of times the clients drive the direction of what you're kind of focusing on.
That's interesting. It's a lot more back and forth than I guess I would have predicted. But it makes sense. I guess I'm not an optimization person. So like, I'm kind of imagining they're just like, here, fix our product. And we're like, okay. And then you just mess with it and magic happens and then you get it back and it works. But it's good to hear that there's a lot more conversation. Cause I think that, I guess that is a good point. Like, certain things might not be able to fit within the deadline. But being able to, decide on what things are priority is important, and you can't do that unless you were working on a project from jump. So I guess that makes sense. Huh.
Jared, have you ever been asked to? I'm sure the answer is yes, but I guess what I'm really asking is, can you talk about a time where you were brought in partway through a project and they're like, optimize this, and you're like, I don't know if I can within the constraints that you're giving me, and you had to really push back. Has that happened to you? And
yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, without getting
He's
into
like, yeah.
more points for Alan.
Dang it.
You know, without getting into specifics of what project, you know, sure. There have been projects where I've been brought on, you know, late or after the game has shipped, and, you know, the client will be like, hey, we have this huge, you know, partnership with whoever, we need to hit this date, we need to get it running on the platform, we need to get it optimized, etc. And, you know, sometimes, like when I was working for myself, you know, I had a company that I was contracting with, and I had this one where it was like, this is way, way too much for myself. And I talked to one of my buddies and brought him onto the team, and we were able to kind of tag team things. But one of the interesting things about optimization is that I'd say it's kind of like logarithmic progress, where you make a lot of progress in the beginning. The you know, you're able to find, oh, you know, somebody added an extra loop here and it's just doing nothing, and, you know, you're able to get these easy wins that might, you know, take a big chunk out of the performance. Or the overhead, rather. But then the closer you get to like your performance target, the problems you're solving get more difficult and more difficult, and each gain you get is smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, you know, if a game was running at, you know, 15 frames per second and you need to get it to run to 60, probably getting it from 50 to 40 is probably not that hard. Getting it from 40 to 50 is probably pretty hard. And then that last little bit from like 50 frames a second to like a solid 60 is just, sometimes it's just the worst.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Huh.
Yeah. It's the 80-20 rule, right?
Yeah. Like,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
80% of the gains took 20% of the effort, and the last 20% is going to take 80% of the effort.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And I suppose, I mean, it's very situational, because we talked about a couple of different contexts, right? Yeah. Like, there's the stage you're brought in, whether it's a project that you are working on with the team in-house or a port, where there's certain things you can or can't change. And so, yeah, I guess every component of it changes based on that as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you need to be flexible. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's a little bit scary looking at the code for the first time because you have no idea what you're going into.
Right.
Like, maybe it's a game that ran beautifully on PC, but then once you put it on something that's using a mobile chipset, it just dies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is also an argument for not pre-optimizing, which is if you design and test and you're like just hovering a little below 60, but you're doing fine,
yeah,
and everything's really sloppy,
yeah,
then when it's time to optimize, hoo boy.
Oh, suddenly
you can put it on a mobile phone.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas if you are diligent, then, and this is, you know, your ambition grows because it's running really well.
Yeah.
You could do a little bit more and that changes. And so I suppose you probably get projects that come to you that are in terrible shape, but that you can make get more of those easy wins. And then projects that just need that extra push and are in terrible struggle because they've already, you know, gotten as much as they can out of it.
Yeah. And one of the other factors that we haven't talked about is, so early on I said, you know, if you can be involved early in the process, you can make certain decisions, you can kind of think ahead. And if, you know, maybe you're working on a PC game and you're like, this, you know, uses the keyboard, it's never going to, you know, work on, you know, a console. So we're not even going to consider consoles. You make certain decisions. But then 4 years later, something called a Steam Deck comes out and you're like, oh, this is something that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And it's like a PC, but kind of like mobile. And those decisions you made now need to exist in a context that didn't exist when you were making those calls.
Yeah. And so, dang, I didn't even consider that.
Just speaking hypothetically, not that this has actually happened to you or anything. This definitely sounds like something you had to deal with.
Also, I get to do my sideburn on Valve right now, which is that you can't really opt out of a Steam Deck release.
Yeah.
You can like flag it as not compatible, but you can't choose to not be on that platform, and customers will be mad at you.
Right.
That you didn't port it to what is essentially just a PC.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that it's actually essentially a port.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, PlayStation 4 is an x86 processor. It's basically a PC.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a port, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so burn on Valve for making us all live in that environment.
Yeah,
just so that they can have an instant library for their new device. You know?
So what kind of tools do you use to optimize the games that you're working on? I know very little, but I know that like we use Unity at work. And we use a profiler. I will sometimes use a profiler in order to handle that. Unity's innate profiler, which I've heard is not that good, but I actually don't know anything about it, if it's good or not. So are there other kinds of tools and things you use to get at the heart of the core of the issues?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're using an engine, you know, the two most popular, Unity and Unreal, they have built-in profilers.
Yeah.
And you can run those to, you know, see what's going on, see what's taking the longest, see how long something's taking. And usually a first step is just taking a look at a profiler on like the PC.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what jumps out and, oh, there's something weird on the graph. Oh, you know, this is a whole system that we don't use anymore, but it's still running in the background, things like that. But the best place to optimize, and Mark kind of, you know, touched on this a little bit, is the actual device. So if you're targeting, you know, a console, you want to make sure you're testing on the console and getting the actual data back from the device. If you're releasing on phones, you want to actually run it on phones. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, PCs are still like orders of magnitude faster than consoles and PCs when it comes to processing. They're also different architectures. You know, they use slightly different, you know, instruction sets. They use slightly different processors. And just the way that certain processors handle certain things can be wildly different between platforms. And it's not something you can predict.
Yeah.
It's something that you actually have to see on the device. So personally, I was working on one of my indie games, you know, years ago, and I was playtesting it and working on the PC and playtesting it. And then once I brought it on the, you know, phone, it didn't work. You know, the controls weren't right and, you know, it wasn't running right. And I, you know, kind of learned that lesson that, oh, you know, I was just developing on the PC because it was easy to test there. But, you know, it's extra work to getting it running on the phone, but there's no substitute to getting it running on the device and getting data back.
Yeah, that makes sense. I when I worked on this game Treasure Stack a while back. I mostly developed it on PC. But then we were planning on porting it to Switch and Xbox One at the time. Definitely when we ported it to Switch, there were a ton of complications that I could not have predicted because we didn't have a Switch. We didn't have access to a Switch at the time. So it was definitely eye opening to see that, how different it was. Mm-hmm. And it took me forever to like figure out how to even hook up the profiler in Unity to work with the Switch. And I think I did it and I gave up on it because it didn't work very well at the time. So I just kind of eyeballed it, which I'm sure it's not good practice, but
I think that's probably the difference where if indies working on their own, trying to figure out how to set up these types of environments.
Yeah.
Because I think game engines have done a lot to make things relatively plug and play. Mm-hmm. Like if you know how to write a for loop, you can make a video game.
Yeah.
Like, but at the same time, when it comes to like packaging, delivery, testing, the things that become where you sort of turn it from a hobby to a profession.
Mm-hmm.
You can go a long way without knowing a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I would not dissuade anybody from going a long way without knowing any of that stuff. A lot of that stuff can be overrated.
Yeah.
But it does, when you don't know it, it does limit you.
Right.
And that because so many people go so far without it, it seems that it's harder to learn because there's fewer people who need to learn it or know that they need to learn it.
Yeah.
Definitely had that problem on Widget Satchel when we were doing it, when I was doing console ports for that. I was hooking up the profiler and it wasn't giving me the information I needed because I didn't understand it was worked a little differently than when you just do it directly in the Unity editor.
Yeah.
And then when I did get that information, I was like, oh, I learned the tiniest bit from this that I kind of could have guessed, but I didn't understand when to trust the process versus when to trust my own instinct.
Yeah.
And so I felt pretty lost. I bet that's a really common experience for people who sort of start down this path is you feel like you got to learn all this stuff and then you kind of can't. But then also it doesn't matter sometimes. And then that really doesn't motivate you to try again.
And that
limits what you're capable of doing
as a developer. I really love that idea. And I'm going to pitch that back to Jared. Can you describe, as best as you can, your like journey into optimization? Like where you started, how you decided you wanted to do this?
Well, he came into video games better set than I think most of us.
Mm.
Did you feel like you had a bit of a superpower, or did you have to relearn it for games?
A lot of the optimization, that I learned in, college, or that I learned when I started doing it for like enterprise, like web systems, a lot of that applies to games as well.
Okay.
So, where I started was, one of my first jobs out of college, I was a web engineer and we managed large systems. And we got this tool, a tool called Dynatrace that's still around today. And you put little agents on every single server, you get the data back, and it lets you analyze the code. It lets you look at the code as it's running. And I was kind of, in charge of getting that set up and installed on all of our servers. I started working with the vendor and, went to some training classes, some conferences, and really started to get into that tool. And so I used that tool for a number of years. And even though it was, web servers, like if you were to take a screenshot of kind of like the graphs there and a screenshot of like the profiler, they'd look pretty similar because, code's still code and figuring out where it's slow is kind of the same sort of thing. But like you mentioned, Mark, a lot of things, when it comes to either optimization or just the finishing work in games is stuff that you can't, learn in school. It's not stuff that, there's a YouTube video that shows you every single thing. A lot of that is, stuff you have to learn. It's like institutional knowledge and, a studio or a company. And yeah, a lot of that can get really, really tricky.
It's been a while since we've asked about this, but Mark was looking through some more numbers, as Mark is wont to do, I guess.
Don't make me the numbers person.
Okay, I was looking at him.
That's not my personality.
We're not the ones doing it, Mark.
So I was looking at these numbers.
Anyways, we're here to ask you to leave a review on your favorite podcast app. We used to ask about these all the time. And particularly we would like try to hammer down the Apple podcast because like you can add like more text. And
that's kind of where that was the whole ballgame.
Yeah.
Right? Like when you launch a show and as it grows, that's where it would go.
Mm-hmm.
New Spotify does ratings.
Yes.
The podcast app that I use, Pocket Casts, which I really like, that recently started doing ratings.
Cool.
And we started getting a bunch of them. So apparently they're very discoverable in the little 5 stars there. Mm. But Apple Podcasts is still the place to go to leave a review in your own words as to what you like about the show.
Yes.
But any way you listen to the show, if your podcast app has a place to give us 5 stars, we'll take every one of them.
The better we look to people when they haven't potentially looked at the listened to the podcast before, the better, the more likely they'll listen to it, the more likely they'll become part of the community, and the more likely they'll have hot takes for you to discuss on Discord.
What's been nice about, and we don't have any kind of like way to know how well this works, so it might just be warm and fuzzies, but a lot of our reviews in Apple Podcasts just talk about how different the show is from other podcasts.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate that because that is a goal of ours,
yeah.
is to be a different kind of show, a little bit, not necessarily sunnier, but a little less cynical, a little bit more supportive, and hopefully more diverse in opinion and perspective and value. Mm. And it's nice when people say that's happening. So if for no other reason than to make us feel good about what we're doing here, we would love if you gave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars anywhere you can.
Yeah.
There's more that I'm sure I'm not even aware of. And, you know, if you want to give us a bad review, I mean, you could. You know.
That's for the feedback form.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As you were describing your setup when you were working in web dev, the thing that occurred to me was it's like IT, kind of.
Mm.
It's less programming and a lot of it. And like I think a lot of people who are programmers, like they fix their parents' computers. Mm. Like they know how to set the clock on a VCR or whatever. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
we kind of have some of that knowledge. But as I've gotten older, I've felt less and less proud of my ability to go into the Windows registry.
Mm.
And so,
okay.
I don't think of that as part of my like geek identity anymore.
Oh, sure.
I just don't care about it as much.
Yeah.
And I think just the way you were describing it, Jared, is like why it's frustrating is because that's kind of a lot of the same kinds of things is setting up a system rather than writing code or design, you know.
Sure.
So I wonder if that people with different backgrounds, I wonder if people who have a stronger IT background coming into development would be more suited to, because I mean, there's the actual work that you need to make the optimizations, but it's the investigation that's probably most of the work, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because on one of the optimization teams, we were kind of like the CSI investigators, like, you know, the servers went down, there was a huge outage, you know, it took, you know, the support team like 7 hours to get everything back up and running. And then, you know, we'd come in and look at all the data that was collected and kind of need to figure out what happened. And it might be like, oh, you know, somebody pushed out a update to this system 2 weeks ago. But once a month, you know, this process happens and this update is like 100 times slower. And we didn't notice it for 2 weeks because this process happens once a month. And then it happened and this slowed down. Then this made this database lock up and then, you know, everything else. And so Yeah, we'd kind of almost like, you know, investigate the crime scene and figure out what was going on. And once you have that data, then, you know, it's almost kind of like a map of what needs to be optimized, what priority things are. But like you said, yeah, a lot of times, you know, one of those analyze, you know, sessions analyzing things might have taken 3-4 days, a week, maybe longer.
Yeah. Well, your metaphor is much more exciting than mine. I think crime scene investigator sounds way more fun than IT manager. So let's go with that. Because I mean, I've said it a couple times, but it's just framing it in terms of like motivation.
Yeah.
When it is not your job.
Yeah.
I think when it's your job, I think like any, you get good at it and you could be proud of your work.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it's something that you have to do that you didn't want to do, which is I think true just for a lot of indies.
Yeah.
And so I guess maybe that's a question of, because you've done it in multiple contexts, right? You've done it outside of games, inside of games, as an indie developer, as part of a studio team. So you are in probably the best position to compare these things. When is it, say, as an indie developer, when is it time to just like, not give up, but like devote only so much because you only have so much to devote to the whole project?
You have enough juice. You're good. You can stop squeezing.
Yeah.
I mean, one, I think it kind of depends on like the specific game and like the direction you're going, but I'm also kind of the camp of good enough is good enough.
Yeah.
Like if you're playing something and it feels good and yeah, it might have a little bit of a drop here and there, but like there's so much going on screen that like people aren't going to notice. Like, I think that might be fine. You know, if it's going to take you 7 weeks and, you know, sleepless nights to get that little bit out, like, is that worth it?
Yeah.
But, you know, other games where, you know, it's a 60 FPS competitive game and, you know, there's these drops here and there, like something like that, it might not be acceptable to have, you know, an unstable frame rate or frame pacing or things like that. And so I think a lot of it's, you know, dependent on the context, because without getting into specifics, there's certain, you know, YouTube channels or sites that will analyze things and they'll have frame graphs and they'll be like, you know, there's a 2-frame dip, you know, when you do this one action. And
literally
like,
unplayable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, right. Like, yeah, if you're, you know, have a graph hooked up to it and you're literally looking at every frame, that's technically true. But right. If nobody pointed it out to you, I bet you wouldn't have noticed it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I do think that there is a point where, you know, it's maybe not worth it. And I'm not saying, you know, I have anything against those channels. Like, I watch them, you know, all the time. But I do think that there is a point where you just need to scale back and think, you know, we're playing games, we're enjoying it. Is this really hurting my enjoyment? Or is this kind of just a technical thing?
Is it just nitpicking for the sake of it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I definitely... not necessarily these channels, but just like we complain about gamers a lot on this show. But gamers will oftentimes like be annoyed that like a game is poorly optimized when like, you know, their PCs are very old or something like that. And I mean, honestly, sometimes that is the case. Sometimes a game is just not well optimized because they had deadlines or something.
Right. There's a lot of times these things are choices.
Yeah,
not failures,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very bluntly, what do they know?
You right.
Know?
But I mean, but at the same time, I personally find it really frustrating when people are like, wow, the devs didn't know what they were doing and they just poorly optimized their game. When like there's so many different factors and things that go into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's difficult from an outsider's perspective to like really understand that. From a viewer's perspective, they're just like, they're playing a game and it's going really slow and it's supposed to be running at 60 frames and it dips at 15 sometimes.
Right. It's not them being mean-spirited when those thoughts occur to them,
right?
It's just they don't quite understand how it works. It's not like actually their fault.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, Jared, how do you feel about that kind of talk? I assume you don't like go on to Twitter or whatever and go like you're wrong because you'd be doing that all day and that'd be your job and that's not that's not good.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's impossible to know what was going on unless you have like a firsthand account because like you said, a lot of times it could, I mean, I'd say 60-70% of the time, if I had to guess, like it's because of deadlines.
Yeah.
You know, the publisher put a deadline here, the studio put a deadline here, the console partner put a deadline here. And it's like, oh, you know, this console partner said, you know, we could be part of this promotion if we get, you know, whatever in by, you know, this date. But if not, you know, we're going to miss the holiday season or something like that. So it's like, you know, a hard choice. But then, you know, there's other times where it's like, you know, maybe there's like a frame jitter, like every couple seconds or something like that. And the devs find out it's a bug in the engine. And they're like, oh, if we just upgrade like from this version of the engine that we've been using for, you know, 2 years to this next version of the engine, it will fix that bug. But management will say, hey, we don't want that risk. Don't upgrade.
Right.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
And the devs are just kind of stuck. And so, you know, it's impossible to know those types of situations and what's going on without talking with somebody. And most of the time it's, you know, external forces, external, you know, factors.
Right.
Sometimes it might be, you know, maybe this is a studio's first game on this platform and there's an experience element. But a lot of times that will come down to time as well, where they needed to get the game out by a certain date, so they didn't get to do as much R&D, they didn't get to do as much testing, they didn't have as much time to play around with the hardware and learn how it works.
Yeah. I mean, you've been describing these sort of combination of factors, right?
Yeah.
Both ones that are imposed on you and then choices you make, right? Like you say, it's not about hitting 60 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's about, does this feel right? And that is, you know, I think presumably on a bigger project, you write things down and have direct, specific, enumerable targets, maybe a little bit more often than a smaller indie does, but you're all chasing that. Why are we trying to hit these targets so we can achieve this feeling?
Yeah.
We missed this target by a little bit, but we've still achieved the feeling, so we're good. And I asked you earlier about indie games, but I think what you said really scales very well, because you're not talking about like, oh, we can only spend this much time on this project, but we have a team of seven on this project, so we can spend more time on it. It's like you're just trying to make sure that does this feel right? Does this work? Does this run well in a subjective sense?
Yeah.
And that goes right on to the topic about how your audience appreciates it, right? Because you're going to get those videos and you're going to get people in Steam replies, but generally you're going to get people feeling that thing.
Yes.
Right. And so that does sound like it scales really well across. And I guess the message is, if you have no resources, you can still reach that feeling. Right. Yeah. It just, you might not have all the tools or abilities or time to optimize to a certain degree, but that isn't your goal. Again, your goal isn't 60, right? Your goal is that feeling. And if that means you need to make compromises elsewhere, then that's optimization too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I'll just clarify and say this is kind of my philosophy and my approach. I know, you know, different studios might have different approaches. Sometimes the different performance targets are dictated by a publisher or partner, things like that. Mm-hmm. But another thing that you kind of mentioned is, you know, maybe you're in a situation where, you know, you have this ridiculous, you know, finishing animation with these particles and the characters doing all this flips, and somebody's tried optimizing it for weeks and weeks and they can't get there.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just a better call to scale that back, or maybe, you know, you have them do a dance instead, and, you know, you still get that feeling, you still get, you know, what the design was intended to do, but you take a completely different route, and that's a completely valid way of optimizing things as well.
This is the angle where everything becomes everything, which we keep coming back to on this podcast, but it makes sense. I mean, like, I like what Mark said is this, you know, your target isn't necessarily a number unless it is, it is a player experience. And so if you take that mindset to optimization, it opens up potentially other avenues to making optimization easier or not having to optimize a specific thing, which I guess is like the easiest form of optimization.
Is living with it.
So,
absolutely.
I think we might have touched on this earlier, but Jared, I'm really curious if you've ever found yourself over optimizing something. And how did you catch yourself in that?
Trying to think, because I think I probably have, and I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, I guess, you know, in a broad sense, another thing that's important is to get your game in front of, you know, other people, and especially people who haven't experienced it before.
Oh, yeah, playtesting.
Exactly.
We love playtesting on the show.
Just like how playtesting is, you know, completely crucial to, you know, game design and getting feedback, because, you know, especially when you're looking at, you know, a game from 2 inches away for, you know, a couple of years, you don't see it, you know, objectively.
Yeah.
And so getting somebody who hasn't seen your game to play it and to get that feedback sometimes can let you know whether what you were focusing on was worth it or not. Because, you know, I can think of times when, you know, maybe I've been working on a feature or a specific thing and I've had like a specific goal in mind or a specific thing that I wanted people to feel or see. And then, you know, I get it in front of playtesters and they don't notice it or they don't have, you know, a problem with it being a little bit janky.
Yeah.
And sometimes, yeah, you know, you can have an idea of what you want, but without confirming it from players, you don't know if you're necessarily on the right track.
Yeah. And then you got to decide, why am I doing this? Because if you're doing it for yourself, then that's great. Doesn't matter if the players notice it. If, if you are really doing it for yourself.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it for the players, it's important if they notice it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's true. That's true. I do want to ask, this may be going to look bad on me, but I'm curious.
Now I'm really curious.
are there any particular coding practices that you've had to deal with that have made optimization difficult in the future? Oh, you're shaking your head. Okay.
I kind of know where you're going with this, Steven.
Yeah. Tell me why I'm wrong and what I should be changing in my code.
And this kind of goes back to when I was saying, you know, optimization, I kind of feel is like logarithmic, where you can make a lot of progress in the beginning. And then as you get closer to where you need to be, it gets harder.
Yeah.
So if we're talking specifically like about Unity, there's a lot of convenience features in Unity or a lot of convenience features in C#. That might be great for like web dev or might be great for, you know, a desktop application. But when you're trying to run it, you know, 30, 60 frames a second, doesn't fly. So okay. Kind of a big offender is Link.
No.
Link is.
I use it a lot.
Got him.
And I'll just, for listeners, this is L-I-N-Q.
Yeah.
It's a package that you can use in most C# projects.
Link is a system that just lets you use shorthand to get data back. Mm. If you want, you know, specific data, if you want to sort your data a certain way, it makes it very easy to just get that back. But Link, you know, one, it's a lot slower than other ways of doing it. Two, it creates, you know, garbage and overhead, and that kind of stuff accumulates and, you know, causes frame drops and large frame spikes and things like that. So going through and removing Link, you know, if I'm working on like a Unity porting project or optimization, is just usually step one.
Okay.
And I usually even just like remove the declaration from the class, because I found like if you have one bit of Link in a file and you just leave it, somebody else comes along and will add a little bit more Link, and somebody else will add more. And then I like to call it Link creep.
Yeah.
Where just like you have it in there and it just kind of grows.
But it's such magic, though.
Yeah.
It's too good to be true is what it is.
I guess so. Oh, that's wild. I'll be making sure to probably use it a little less in the future. Or maybe I could keep using it and it'll be a good win for the optimization down the line.
But at the same time, you know, like I was saying, good enough is good enough. If you're using Link and it's not causing any problems, like, okay.
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. I'm justified in my decisions.
Steven, you've taken the wrong message away from me.
As I want to do. That is good to hear. I'm glad to know that Link can be an issue for optimization, because I do tend to use it. I mean, I don't use it like excessively. At least I'd like to say that I don't use it excessively. But I do tend to use it when I'm like, I don't want to type up a whole bunch of lines of code to do one line of work if I just use Link.
I don't know where I got this habit, but when I want to do something and I'm just crawling through the autocomplete and something pops up and then I check, oh, this imported Link. Like, I get suspicious. And I don't know where I got that habit from, but I must have been told at some point that it was not great, but I've never experienced how slow it is. Yeah. And so I knew that it was like, if you can avoid it, it's kind of like Git component. Like, yeah, you can do it, but like, if you can ever avoid it, always avoid it.
Yeah.
That's kind of my attitude for it. I didn't realize it was that, like, that's step one. That's news to me even. Mm. So then what's step two?
Next after that, this is usually a quick win, switching all your for each loops to for loops. And it depends on the type of platform you're on. If you're on a PC, probably a completely different approach. But if you're on any sort of platform that's, you know, limited hardware, that has limited resources, switching all your for each loops, or not necessarily like going through the project and you know, swapping them all out, but, you know, maybe something that happens every frame, maybe a system that is slow, you'll find those ones. But switching out all the for each loops to for loops, like, yeah, you got to use a little bit more code. Yeah, sometimes it's a little bit more gross looking and it's not as clean. And, you know, it's technically more lines of code, but it's a trade off between, you know, developer efficiency and code efficiency.
Right.
And yeah, a for each loop makes it easier to code and you can just kind of keep flow state. But once it's time to optimize and you can switch that for a for loop, you'll be able to, you know, sometimes, especially if it's something that's running a lot, you can gain like a considerable amount of performance gains from that.
Yeah,
go ahead. That was something I was going to ask about. I know enough about programming to know what a for loop is, and I can intuit what a for each loop is. And it makes sense what you said, that it's easier in the moment to probably write a for each loop than a for loop. And I wonder if that isn't maybe an approved practice of, okay, you're just getting stuff on paper. You want to get your ideas out of your head into the game, write your for each loop, go nuts. And then make a note, put a sticky note on the wall and say, okay, for loop. And you just go back and you go through the process where needed to swap it out. Yeah. I'm sure I've done something similar to that in different contexts, not in code. I just can't think of any instances, and I'm not getting picked on like Steven. So
Ellen's like, I can't think of any time I've really done it wrong. Just can't think of a single time. I'll definitely use a for each for aesthetic reasons, right?
Really?
It reads better, and I know it might not be as efficient, but I kind of just cross my fingers the compiler will optimize it.
Yeah.
Because I've heard that before between for and for each.
Huh.
But I think that's always kind of a false promise. But I kind of live on that false promise.
That's actually really fascinating, because that's one of the things I have trimmed out of all of my code. I don't ever use for each loops anymore.
Really?
Yeah. I think when I worked at Pixel Lake, somebody was like, don't use for each loops. I'm like, okay. Yeah. I took it as gospel, I guess.
Well, it's like what I heard about Link. It's like you trust it, you heard it, and you just adapt your practice.
Yeah.
But I'm not good about that one.
I just want to say I've never used Link. Not once.
See, great. You're doing even better than me.
Yes. The student has become the master.
Oh, that's good.
So when it comes time to update a game, I think especially you have a live service game, you have a patch, you have, and it, whether it's a port or an in-house project, I imagine the optimization for an already optimized game is a whole nother story. And one of the things that we've talked about on this show before for multi-platform games is the idea of keeping one code base is really important when you're doing that if your own project. And working with porting houses, it can be very difficult because, like, as you were describing, sometimes you just get the code and are asked to change it. What happens if 6 months down the line, that company does a patch with new content or their own updates in performance or graphical quality or anything that sort of touches? Then you've got to make those same updates with whatever you've changed in your, so like, what are the, I think the technical issues of it are interesting, but I'm actually much more interested in like the politics of it. Hmm. Like, how do you navigate that? How do you work with a publisher to say like, listen, this is actually gonna take three times as long because I have to unravel a bunch of my own spaghetti, and the publisher might not be sympathetic to that argument, or trying to work with the original developer team and saying, hey, these are the optimizations I've made. Can you put that back into your original code base so that you've, for those learnings? And I'm just really curious about that, the relationships of that when you're working with essentially somebody else's project, or how much better, or maybe it's not better when you're doing it in-house.
Yeah, so this is a question that is going to be like extremely like situation specific.
Sure.
And I think probably the biggest factor in this is contracts. Because, you know, when you're starting a relationship with, you know, a porting studio, or a porting studio is starting a relationship with a client, as if everybody's doing their homework, there should be terms that should cover these types of things in the contract. So, you know, this is the duration of the contract. This is the terms, you know, we're going to port this game. But then there should be a section in there, you know, we're going to provide 6 months of support up to a maximum of, you know, 20 hours per week for 4 engineers. Like, I'm just making something up.
Sure.
But those types of terms would be, you know, defined to where if the porting studio is thinking ahead, you know, they don't want to say, oh, we'll support this game forever. or we'll do, you know, however many patches you need. Because then you're stuck in a situation where it's like people are continuing to make decisions that are outside of your control. But you're beholden to, you know, their decisions, and you have to deal with them indefinitely. That's not a situation anybody wants to be in.
Yeah.
But also, you know, publishers could play into this, because sometimes when you're working with a publisher, you don't actually have the keys to be able to release the patch. And so you need to get the patch to a certain point, or else the publisher is not going to release it. Or maybe, you know, the publisher has, you know, financial incentives tied to specific targets or specific dates. And so a lot of that stuff is, you know, kind of contract based and should be thought out ahead of time. But I also imagine there's probably weird edge case situations that, you know, people have run into and have gotten in, yeah, sticky situations.
Yeah, I know that. I'm just thinking of the closest example in my work is when, after we finished Widget Satchel, I was looking into where else could we port it before, like, my next project sort of took over my life. And one of the ones is we're going to do a web version, because there was this company that was doing, it was like a portal kind of company. And I don't know, you know, if they exist anymore, but there was a brief, like, 3 month period where I was kind of working on porting it and trying to keep the code base from not breaking the other versions.
Yeah.
And I ended up breaking it.
Oh no!
But it, you know, it's just on, you know, my the project, and I kind of had to unwind a bunch of stuff, and that's when I gave up because I couldn't, because I was so committed to the idea of just one code base, that I couldn't do what needed to be done for that. And that, just thinking about how much harder that would be when you're working with multiple people. This was me, like, arguing with myself.
Yeah, sure, right,
about it. And so yeah, just like you say, it's situational. Right. There's no template for anything. It sounds like. Is that exciting, or is it just depressing?
I mean, it's different now, you know, that I work for a studio, and, you know,
yeah,
people who manage and do all that stuff. But when I was, you know, indie working for myself, it was a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't know quite what you were getting, and so it was this kind of scary unknown, but it was also exciting because, you know, you're always working on something different, you're always being exposed to different styles of games, different styles of design, coding, different code bases, and so it's always just kind of, you know, interesting. So a little bit of both.
One of the things I really love about doing interviews on this show is getting to speak to people like yourself, Jared, who have, like, this deep expertise, knowledge, and experience in a part of game making that I have really no idea about. Mm-hmm. And that kind of mirrors some aspects I really like about my job, too, because in the job that I do, I'm working with a lot of different customers in a lot of different contexts. And you get to learn about things that you just, like, weren't necessarily... It wasn't on your radar. It wasn't, you know, you just weren't on that wavelength. And now it's like, I think I'm going to notice, like, a buttery smooth frame rate or something a lot more than I would have, you know, a day ago before speaking with you. So thanks for going through the basics with us and the maybe more advanced stuff. I don't know enough to tell what's advanced and what's basic. because at the very least, it's like, it's another layer of appreciation I can bring to playing games. And also, I know who to go to for questions. That's our show. You can find Jared online at Jared Huntley, and you can find him like that everywhere. But we are going to put links to those locations in the show notes, along with other links to resources and different things that you probably want to know about, like logarithms. Go to our website, nicegames.club. You can visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and reading the documentation. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and tell us your optimization stories. Next week, we'll be looking at scoring 101 and turning off the game dev brain. That's it for this week.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
That makes sense. And, well, I had a point and I forgot where it was going. So I guess cut this out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.